with her.
Is my associate indiscreetly told you we don't have names?
You've only seen us.
That's all I could do after you closed the shades. Agent Scully.
You are under the Constitution?
Yes. It's what allows foreign terrorists to live here and enjoy the American dream until time comes to destroy it.
Tommy knows, and we're here at the bunker in Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Well, we're also at resist.com, where you can get a better, much better than a Harvard education, I'm telling you. We got guys running for political office and running for the president here that are Harvard graduates. We got that new false flag Albright program on the internet too that swears they hate racism, but they're right wingers and they love the Constitution and so forth. Excuse me, couldn't get to my kill button fast enough. Gee. Well, it looks like the Trumpites won in New York City. What else? I'm just trying to figure out exactly how they're going to derail Trump. I'm pretty sure they're going to do it. I think it'd be a hell of a lot of fun, though, that if he makes it into running against the bitch, the witch, Hillary, that would be a lot of fun. So in that case, I sort of like to see him go all the way, because it doesn't make any difference between the two. I know Trump says some of the things that make you happier than other things, but it's all smoke and mirrors, boys and girls. So I don't know whether they've got anybody really primed to move in there and take over when they boot Trump out. But let's wait and see. Maybe he will go all the way, and that'll be lots of fun on into November. Sure will. I can't wait. Hey, they got a big Trumpite get together down in Indianapolis, Indiana today. They're even starting to, the pundits are starting to talk about Indiana being really important in this thing. It may be the key state and all that kind of crap. The media or something else. Anything to jazz up the viewership. You know, they just want lots of viewers so they can sell their soap and cars and crap. So they're going to say anything that builds that up, you know. So don't get all you Hoosiers that are listening in here, don't get excited. Indiana in the stream of things doesn't mean very much. Sorry, if it went independent as a state and stood up on its hind legs and fought like a mongrel dog, then it would be worth something. But primarily it goes along with Washington, yeah. Well, let's get back to the Pessimist Guide to History. You know I like that book. I'm not sure. I don't think I read this. But it's pretty interesting, if not. 1862, the Battle of Antietam. On September the 17th, in the fields near Antietam Creek, just north of the small Maryland town of Sharpsburg, 40,000 Confederate soldiers under General Robert E. Lee faced a Union force with more than twice as many men, so that'd be around 80,000. The shots fired early that morning marked the beginning of what was to become the bloodiest day of the Civil War. Everybody fighting for the Union guys fighting for the rich multimillionaire industrialists of the North. and the Southern boys fighting for the rich agricultural people of the South, early capitalism. So that's interesting, isn't it? The battle began at dawn when the Union artillery loosed a withering barrage of shell and canister on General Stonewall Jackson's Confederate infantry, which was positioned on one side of the cornfield. Union soldiers then tried to charge through the rows of corn, but Confederate riflemen mowed them down with rifle fire. At 7 a.m., Jackson received reinforcements and succeeded in driving the Union forces back. The point of the attack now shifted to the southeast, where the Confederate troops were positioning along a sunken road. After almost 4 hours of bitter fighting, Union soldiers overran the sunken road, which was so littered with dead and dying that it was christened Bloody Lane. Meanwhile, farther east, Union General Ambrose Burnside's troops were incurring heavy losses trying to cross a bridge defended by the Georgia sharpshooters. At 1 p.m., the Federals successfully stormed the bridge, threatened to cut off Lee's line of retreat until Confederate reinforcements arrived to help drive Burnside back. The fighting ceased as night fell. Neither side claimed victory. The following day, Lee withdrew his battered troops across the Potomac. The number of, you see, he's clear up there by the Potomac, close to Washington, D.C. at this point. The number of killed and wounded totaled 12,410 for the North and 10,700 for the South, more casualties than any other single day of fighting in the Civil War. And the South couldn't afford to lose as many troops because they were outnumbered 7-1 in the military. The North outnumbered the South from the very beginning of 7-1. America's Civil War is known as the first modern war in history. No, I say it was the first genocidal war in the United States towards white people. There were nearly 1 million casualties on the battlefields. Welcome to the industrial age. Well, there you go, Whitey. That's how you do it. Kill yourself off. For the big shots and the money men and the darkies. 1863, the New York City draft riots. I think I read this once before, but in case you forgot, something to remember. The first federal draft law was passed on March 3, 1863, to furnish raw recruits for the Union armies then fighting the Civil War. The law immediately aroused bitter resentment among many in the North, especially in New York, where the law threatened to affect mostly indigent Irish laborers crammed into barely habitable tenants. Even New York State Governor Horace Seymour furiously opposed the measure. These guys didn't want to go off and fight for the blacks, to free the blacks. In fact, they don't even want to get in the country. Two provisions of the new law particularly outraged the opponents of the draft: the sale of draft exemptions for $300 and an exclusion of blacks. Stupid white man. The exemption meant that those with money could buy their way out of serving in the army, unfairly shifting the burden on the poor whites, such as New York City's Irish laborers. Whether President Abraham Lincoln even had the right to conscript men was also a subject of heated debate. Well, Lincoln was a dictator. If you don't realize that, you don't realize anything. He was the first American dictator. Despite the opposition, the law was passed. The Union desperately needed men as the war with the South dragged on and casualties mounted. The first draft lottery was held on Saturday, July 11th, And on Sunday, the newspapers published the names of the first 1,236 draftees. New York City's Irish neighborhoods simmered with resentment, aggravated by the midsummer heat. On Monday, July 13th, the resentment turned to outright anger as knots of draft opponents armed themselves with clubs, crowbars, and brickbats and began collecting at the draft office at 677 3rd Avenue. At 10 a.m., a mob of 500 protesters, white protesters, surrounded the building, started throwing bricks and stones, and then broke into the building. Rioters seized and destroyed the lottery records while terrified employees escaped out the rear. Whipped into a frenzy, rioters set the building on fire, which in turn set the whole block ablaze. You see, these white people back then, they had what it takes, man. They went to riot. By noon, the mob had swollen to 50,000 rioters. Well, that's an army, boys, who fanned out along 3rd Avenue, looting and burning everything in the area. Police could do little to control the mob. Superintendent John A. Kennedy rushed to the draft office and tried to subdue the crowd, but after being brutally assaulted and beaten to the ground, he was carried off to the hospital. Oh, I love it. Blacks exempt from the draft became a target of the rioters. Seven were seized and lynched by roving mobs. Another 10 or 12 were beaten to death or thrown into the river. Then thousands of rioters attacked and burnt the colored children's orphan asylum, though the 200 children and their guardians managed to escape. Martial law was soon imposed, and the shooting of the rioters began. Soon hundreds of bodies of slain white rioters lay in the streets of New York City's Midtown District, primarily white Irish. At nightfall, scattered gangs of rioters still preyed on the city, though not nearly as widespread as on Monday. Rioting continued until July 16th, when Union regiments arrived from Gettysburg to help police. Before order was restored, a staggering total of 1,200 men, women, and children had been killed. Another senseless riot by an angry mob in the heat of summer. Bullshit. It was a great mob, a great riot, and we should have a hell of a lot more of them. That's Tommy's opinion. And anybody don't like Tommy's opinion about things like this can kiss my hot ass. So we'll end that reading of The Pessimist's Guide to History on those two stories, two great stories of heroes and all that kind of stuff and people that died for their race and their rights and their jobs and their houses and everything else and were willing to go into the streets and kill. Unfortunately, they tend to kill people who are not too much involved when these things happen instead of climbing the steps of the New York City mayor's office and dragging them out. They always forget to go to the top. Look, the problems the South had and the problems that the Northern working man had, they should have gone to the top and not butcher each other in the fields of Antietam. The rioters are sort of lazy. They want to go for easy pickings, but the easy pickings are not the right pickings. You know who the pickings are. You know who had it right? The anarchists back at the turn of the last century. Once they got rolling, they knew where to go. They didn't roll around in the gutter in the street. They went to the top. Well, I see old Donald Trump is upset because they got a nude painting of him and they're going to sell it. The infamous nude of Donald Trump has attracted bids of over £100,000 after it went on display at the Maddox Gallery in Mayfair, London. That might be interesting. You know when they were talking about hands and stuff and who's got the bigger one? Well, there's a chance to find out. a real life oil painting of Donald Trump. Should have that over your bar. This was pretty funny. A college student is removed from a flight after speaking Arabic on a plane. I think that's a little going a little bit overboard, man. Well, the question of the day is it time for gun control in the USA? Well, I say yes. I think it would be the greatest thing for us in the world if the government came out and started picking up guns. It'd be the best thing that ever happened. So come on, give us gun control. Come on out there and take those guns away from the boys. And we'll see what happens. It might work. You know who I think will fight back the most? The blacks. The untouchables. I believe they'll fight the government right down to the wire, where Whitey will probably be meeting the federal people at his front door and giving them all the guns he's got. You don't think so? I know so, because the average white man is a piece of marshmallow. But what do I know? Maybe not. Maybe he'll come down off his high horse, man, if they come out to take the gun. But I just pray that they'll try it. It says here, and keep them guns out of the hands of idiots. Well, I agree. So let's keep the guns out of the hands of the U.S. federal government. Let's empty the arsenals. Don't allow the federal government or their troops to have a gun, because they're the idiots. The only reason they're not mowing you and me down here and they're going overseas to do it is because they can get away with it. They believe me, if they had a good excuse, they'd be mowing us down right now. They're just waiting on a good excuse. It may take a few more years, but it's coming, baby. I wonder if there's still any of those old barrage balloons around in the warehouses from World War I and World War II that, like the Brits, put on a string and had them floating over the city so that the planes would coming in would hit them. Well, that's what we need for these drones, man. Everybody should have one of those barrage balloons. Probably could get them cheap if you could find them. You know, I'm beginning to think some of these Africans are pretty damn smart. You know, I'm so sorry. Francis Cabor, a village militia chief in central Burkina Faso, wherever that's at, grins as he watches five men ride up on a motorbike and tricycle and throw two criminal suspects in their clutches to the ground. The Whites' Sparrowhawks are here, Cabor says proudly of the vigilantes who have brought their captives to a patch of wasteland in Coco Labamba village, about 40 kilometers, 25 miles from the capital of Ouagadougou. Watched by the assembled villagers, the young suspects, criminals, black, a mechanic accused of theft, and a youth who tried to intervene when the mechanic was arrested, are dragged through the red dust to a hut where their backs are bared. They are then tied to a tree to be flogged. Both men seem to be in shock, staring up at the sky, resigning to the beating to come. One of the pair already had bright welts on his back. The village elders, armed with tree branches, stepped forward, and at the sound of a whistle, the lashings began. "Confess that you helped your friend steal gas," one of the elders shouted. When they do not answer, the whipping resumes. Such scenes have become common in the center of the East of the West African country, where self-defense groups known as the Kaglawigogo, environmental protection in the local Maasai language, have set themselves up as judge and jury. By God, yeah. Cheered on by the population grown distrustful, mistrustful of state institutions. They don't call the cops. The first Kaglawigogo Association emerged in the north of the country in the 1990s as an environmental protection force working to combat illegal logging, grazing violations and other environmental offenses, said Boniface Some Desire, professor at the University of Wangawangaluga Sociology Department. But the movement's self-claimed remit has grown over time, particularly in 2 years since the uprising that ousted longtime President Blaise Compaoré from power. The popular fervor of 2014 during the fall of Blaise Compaoré motivated people to fight injustice, determine their own fate, and ensure their own protection, and kick ass. This must be the real black KKK, not the Hollywood. Chrisogon Zugmore, president of the Burkinabe Movement for Human and People's Rights, linked the widespread support of the vigilantes to a galloping increase in insecurity. Well, I guess it's time for that here, too. Setting an example in Kokolangagoga village, Kabor translates as a confession as extracted from the mechanic's accomplice. He was drugged. That's why he fought our men, Kabor relates. Sentences passed. 10,000 francs. That's about $17 for the gas used to transport him to the kangaroo court, the people's court, and to compensate those he injured. And the man's pockets are turned out, eliciting peals of laughter from excited onlookers. Then comes the turn of the mechanic, who had already been beaten earlier in the day. A militia member poured water on his back to reopen the cuts before he was flogged anew. His penalty is heavier, 30,000 francs. Quote, say you will never steal again. Working for food is better than stealing, unquote, the villager elder says, chastising the pair. The Kagla Wigilio Association in Kakakola, Guglagaga, has about 1,200 members, mostly traders, cattlemen, according to Kabor. Quote, before there used to be about 20 thefts every month. Today there are only one or two, unquote. He said during the public trials, set an example to others. Yeah. The rise of the Kagla Wigo have sparked a debate in the country of 19 million, with some witnesses accusing them of branding people as criminals merely to extort money from them. Just rumors, that's just rumors. Several criminal cases involving the Kagla Wigo have made headlines recently. In February, a group of Kagla Wigo flogged a suspect thief to death in Sapoy, 100 kilometers from Uangalugagua, and refused to let the police arrest those responsible. By March 10th, Kagla Wigo members were jailed for beating up a suspected thief in Fota in the east, prompting hundreds of supporters to block the major road leading to Niger, Benin, and Togo with boulders and tree trunks for nearly 2 days. Well, there you go. I think sometimes there's some of these black boys down in Africa know how to handle things. seem to be handling better than we are up here, man. Maybe we can hire some of those black boys from down at the border. Or maybe get rid of some of the local cops and bring some black boys in from Wugabagawaga. Here's some more Africans. They ain't taking this shit no more. Gunmen kill three guards, burn East Darfur governor's house. Well, they've got it right, see? The attack of the governor's house at Rizagati, Savannah. Militia members intervenes 24 hours after clashes between them and the gunmen belong to some group. I don't know which one it is, but there you go. They went to the top, burn the goddamn governor's house down. Well, I see nitwits on the high horse over there in Israel. Somebody, they think, blew up a bus. Luckily, it didn't kill anybody, I guess, which makes pretty piss-poor terrorists, if they're terrorists. Maybe they just had a gas leak and somebody tossed a cigarette, but Netanyahu's going to get them. He's going to get whoever did that, you're going to get him. And that work is funny. He's funny. Boy, those Chicago police, they got it all figured out. Chicago detectives assigned to investigate violent crimes will be moving on Monday from the north side to the west side. But all the Negroes are on the south side. Those detectives don't want their ass kicked. Last I remember, the west side is pretty white. Well, going back to Chicago, this last weekend, three dead. That's not very many for Chicago when there's 15 shot dead in Indianapolis. 32 were wounded in Chicago, so they must have been drunk and couldn't aim straight. They always want to hold that gun sideways. I keep telling them, you're never going to hit anything. You know, it's not nice to be nice. Well, Gaddafi over there, he was doing fine when he was acting so-called as a bastard to the West. Yeah, he was doing okay, knocking airplanes out of the sky and sending bombers around, you know. But he had to get nice and make up to the criminals in Washington. They don't like anybody that's nice to them. So he got it. And that reminds me to tell you, don't ever make a deal with these people in Washington, no matter what, because that's the time you're going to get it. And when are these bastards in Washington going to release all those papers from the 9/11 investigation that were marked top secret, the ones that have the Saudi Arabians pissing their pants and worrying about what's going to happen? When are we going to see those? Snowden? Come on, we need you. Let's have another Snowden. Love those guys. Well, I got something I'll bet you didn't know. Oh, I know you know a lot out there, boys and girls, but you don't know everything and neither do I. How about this? The Christian Zionist officer who helped lay the foundations for the IDF Israeli military. Yeah. When in the midst of World War I, Britain acceded to Vladimir Japanitsky's lobbying and created a Jewish volunteer unit to join in the fight against the Ottomans. It appointed Colonel John Henry Patterson as its leader. Patterson, who was born in Ireland to a Protestant father and a Catholic mother. Oh, we love that Christian religion. Sympathized strongly with Zionism, which might as well call it Jewish fascism, and was an outspoken opponent of anti-Semitism. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why should he be that? Veterans of the unit he commanded later helped form the core of the Haganah. You know, the Haganah that killed English soldiers in Palestine. Patterson died in California in 1947. You see, we even gave him citizenship over here. But it was not until 2014 that his wish to be buried alongside his men in Israel was fulfilled. Not in England, where he was born, or not in Ireland. Not helping the Irish Revolution. He was helping the Kaikich Revolution. Myrna Strapp, the attorney who made the reinternment possible, speaks about Patterson's life and her battle to have his remains brought to Israel. How about that? Well, let's see here. Is that the end of that? I know there's a whole big radio show on this, but we don't have time for that. Anyhow, it's just another Aryan traitor to his own people. Even to his own nation of Ireland, to go fight and train Jews to become Haganah killers that blew up the King David Hotel in Palestine, and who are busy killing as many people as they can. And so there you go. Isn't he a wonderful guy? We need to take his, well, I think it's good, take his ashes or bones or whatever, if they're here in the United States or in Europe, take them down there and dump them in Israel. dump him beside some of those other bastards like Killer Bagan and those guys. Millions of Christians. Oh, I'm not talking about it in some other part of the world. Right here in the United States, right here in my county, right here in my town. Worship these sons of bitches. Worship these Zionist Christians. Yeah, they do. They have more love and camaraderie to them than they do their regular non-Christian, Christians who are not into the Jewish thing. Yeah. So there you go. They're all around you, baby. You could shoot in any direction and hit one of these Zionist worshiping bastards. Well, I see the NS, National Socialists, have a couple of poster girls. Well, that's okay. The more the better. They show a picture of them here. Nice chicks. Nice looking chicks. Revealed the neo-Nazi poster girls who idolize Hitler and fantasize about blowing up mosques. Well, they can't be in the kitchen all the time. Yeah, poster girls for the neo-Nazi movement have been revealed as two Scottish sisters who idolize Hitler and front sickening race hate campaigns. Wow, that's something else, huh, boys? The other side so jealous. Samantha Lambie, 25, and her 20-year-old sibling, Chelsea, are the face of the controversial right-wing Scottish Defence League. Oh, my God. Run for your lives! It's the Scottish Defence League. And have appeared on its posters, according to the Daily Record newspaper. The two mothers are said to be big fans of Nazi leader Adolf Hitler, with Chelsea reportedly declaring her favorite book is Mein Kampf, and Samantha uploading pictures of death masks used by the group. Wow, this is something else. Let's see if I can find any more. Ooh, yeah. Run for your lives. Good-looking Aryan white girls who like who you hate. In the years we have been monitoring the SDL's activities, we have seen a lot of people come and go, said Marie McKinley. What a life these people have, like the southern part of the law. The whole life is just snooping, spying. But they're not very good at it, because they'll never figure out who the real powerful ones are. They're not in plain sight, boys. One of the people behind the Scotland United Against Racist SDL Facebook page. She added, but Samantha seems to have been a constant, and in fact, she and her partner Ryan McHugh currently seem to be central figures, and it's a horrible state of affairs. I can't sleep at night. Chelsea was found guilty of throwing bacon at a mosque in Edinburgh when she was 18, and was previously fined for racially abusing an Asian shopkeeper when she was just 16. The record reports. Well, that's good. In any sane Aryan country, they'd give her an award. They should throw the whole pig, not just a piece of bacon. But there's no reason to mess around. Just get them out of the country. Just load them up and get them out of the country. We don't need to throw bacon at them. Now, Samantha has apparently been spotted at SDL anti-refugee protests with her fiancé and fellow member Ryan McHugh. Run for your lives, Muslims. Her younger sister is also apparently engaged to a member, Josh Wood. Well, congratulations, boys. The SDL, as an organization, are all about hate. Well, yeah, we hate our enemies and we love our friends. That's the way we operate. We hate our enemies. And you hate us, you lying, hypocritical bastards. Which is mainly directed at people of the Muslim faith. Faith. I love that word. It means nothing. Faith is belief without evidence. Show me the evidence. Well, it's not a Muslim faith, it's a Muslim killing machine, because their whole religion's based on killing anybody that doesn't want to become one of them. And it's a race-mixing religion besides. Of course, Christianity is too, and Judaism is too. In fact, of course, there's a lot of sects of the Jews that are less into race-mixing than Christians. Metro.co.uk has contacted the Scottish Defense League for a comment. Oh, well, that's great. We got some new gals in the struggle. But I tell them, watch out. Don't get yourself in a situation where they can take you off the streets for Mickey Mouse stuff. Just wait. The big stuff, the time will come. The time is coming. Do not waste yourself in some silly demonstration. We want to really give them the demonstration. The really big demonstration. Really, really, really big demonstration. They gave us a demonstration, didn't they? It was called 9/11. That wasn't a demonstration. Well, that was, 3,000 dead? Well, it looks like we got another Anton Nazi movie coming out. Director Jeremy Saulnier, I don't know what country that is or what nationality, spent his youth playing in a punk rock band and shooting no-budget zombie films with his friends on a Super 8 camcorder. His third feature film is called Green Room, harkens back to those roots, and is spattered with the blood of at least a few 1980s slasher flicks. Green Room stars Joe Cole, Callum Turner, Anton Yelchin, and Alaya Shawkat as a group of down-on-their-luck punk rockers. Quote, "The ain't rights who scraped up chump change for gigs at local diners." The refreshingly naturalistic camera work, dialogue, and pacing briskly introduce the tightly knit group and their band on the run lifestyle as they careen across Oregon in their sputtering van. After an exhausting drive brings the downcast heroes to a show that pays $16 between the four of them, they lose their tempers with the reporter who set it up and violently demanded another gig for their trouble. When their wish is granted, the film takes a new direction. Until this point, Green Room plays like the lighthearted chronicle of a group of charmingly rebellious kids who probably think they're tough, until their next show finds them thrust into a den of real-life backwoods neo-Nazis. Let's see. From there, nail-biting tension, high-stakes terror, and sudden bursts of brutality dominate. Sounds like a fun movie. The once rambunctious youths find themselves with their tail between their legs as they become increasingly entangled in the illicit dealings of an assortment of hard-boiled skinheads. And we know how they are. The highlight of this carnival of aggression is the venue's owner, Darcy, a droll, elegant figure, played with considerable star power by Sir Patrick Stewart. Darcy's calm, menacing demeanor is particularly effective, juxtaposed with the quivering panic of the band as well as the atavist mayhem of his henchmen. Despite the heavy threat of violence that looms over the majority of Green Room, its atmosphere never becomes too oppressive, largely thanks to its tactically placed comic relief, much like the punk rock itself. The film manages to feel biting, mean-spirited, and fun all at the same time, even lighthearted at some moments. Moreover, the humor never feels cheeky or camp. It's composed of the kind of subtle quips that real friends might make a grim situation. Fortunately, the rural hate mongers of the Green Room are never depicted as campy pantomimes or paper cutouts. As unpleasant as they are three-dimensional figures rife with moral ambiguities, regardless of how ugly and nasty they may be. They are possessed of an almost admirable loyalty to their brothers, not unlike the film's central characters. This realism is what makes the film so compelling. It may even strike a chord similar to the John Borman's 1972 hit, Deliverance. Being confronted by something that manages to feel like both a lampoon and a frightening reality is especially meaningful at a time when rowdy crowds and voters are filling rock and roll-sized stadiums to cheer for the racist rhetoric of a character like Donald Trump, mein Führer. I wonder if they had a riot today in Indianapolis. I guess he's appearing tonight. I know he's got a lot of support here in Indiana. Darcy, addressing the patrons of his bar in the film's third act, asserts, "Remember, gentlemen, this is a movement, not a party." Yet bad behavior among this nation's demagogues and a voter constituency driven by irrational sensationalism has brought a new level to the meaning of the term political party. While Green Room is far from a political film, its non-sensational approach reminds us that these kinds of people are not the stuff of cheap horror movies, but this is American reality. Wow! Better go see Cheap Room when it appears in your town or city or drive-in. It looks like it's appearing in Chicago pretty soon or now. I'll have to check it out. If you're in around Chicago, check it out. They even grudgingly said some halfway decent things about the Skins. How about that? You know, they're redesigning the $10 bill and the $20 bill. Well, I say Harriet Tubman, the so-called founder of the Underground Railroad, will be on the 10, and probably Hillary Clinton will be on the 20. How about that? Or maybe it will be Rosa Parks. Yeah. I don't give a shit anymore. Put all the niggers on the money. You might as well. Yeah, instead of griping and crying about it, say, fuck it. Put them all. I want all niggers on all the money. But you better save the top spots on the $500 and $1,000 bills for kikes. Of course, you never know the Masons still have a lot of power, and you start fiddling with that kind of stuff, usually they get involved. Well, somebody emailed me here and said, no nigger, it won't happen on the $20 bill. Jackson is staying on the 20. The truth is, my source says the only note approved at the moment for change is the $10 bill. In fact, according to an administration official, the switch to the $20 bill incensed the Federal Reserve, made him mad, because issuing a new $20 bill was not even on the horizon, and the complexities are enormous. Redesigning a bill that is high volume, that is used in the vast majority of ATMs, and will include a raised tactical feature, is not expected to be completed until 2030 at the very earliest. And indeed, according to this official, more likely 2035. Well, that's interesting. I've got a few women to support for that on that $20 bill. One would be Elizabeth Dilling, and there's several others there that I'll have to write down. How about Kathy Ainsworth, one of the mothers of the Second Revolution? Well, the Black KKK is at it again up in Chicago. 2 dead, 12 wounded in shootings Tuesday. That's yesterday, right? Wait a minute. What is today? Huh? Wait a minute. No, this is Wednesday. Okay, yesterday. I didn't think I'd get the news that fast. Well, I guess old Cruz got his tit in the ringer again and arguing against gun control. Senator Ted Cruz said that Washington, D.C. and Chicago for years have been right at the top of murder rates, and claimed that most jurisdictions with the worst murder rates have the very strictest gun control laws. Cruz distorts the facts. It's true that Chicago has long been on or near the top of total annual murders, but its murder rate is nowhere near the top, according to the Pew Research Center's analysis of FBI data from 1985 through 2012. Chicago's murder rate in 2014 was the 35th highest among cities with 100,000 or more residents, FBI data showed. Well, what the hell's wrong with my black KKK friends up there? They must be slipping. Washington, D.C. had the highest murder rate 8 times during the 28-year period reviewed by Pew. But the last time the district had the highest rate was 1999. In 2014, Washington, D.C. reported 15.9 murders for every 100,000 people, 29th highest in the country. There's no evidence that the gun control laws resulted in higher murder rates. In fact, studies suggest the opposite. States with higher number of firearms restrictions have lower firearm deaths. And there is only an association between gun control laws and firearm deaths, not a casual relationship, the study shown. Wow. Cruz, you said something not true. Cruz made his remarks at a town hall event on ABC's Good Morning America. A pastor from Bronx, New York, asked the Texas senator what he would do to stop gun dealers from buying guns in southern states and shipping them into my community, unquote. Cruz, who is running second behind Donald Trump for the Republican presidential nomination, said, quote, "The way to solve gun violence, I believe, is targeting criminals, not targeting law-abiding citizens," quote. Well, that's an easy thing to say. Why don't you say target the untouchables? We got to go after the untouchables. Now, on April the 18th, he said, if you look at the jurisdictions with the worst murder rates, most of them are the ones with the very strictest gun control laws. And, of course, there's more untouchables in these communities, because when you put a gun control law in place, the criminals don't hand over their guns, but the law-abiding citizens do. I don't know any law-abiding citizens that do, and it ends up leaving them more vulnerable. Well, let's start with the murder rates. We looked at Chicago and Washington, D.C., and didn't find that they are right at the top of the murder rates. Well, let's see. Wait a minute. Let me see. Is there a list of the ones who are? Oh, wow. According to the FBI figures, Flint, Michigan. Well, that's because they got bad water. You can't blame people for shooting each other if they got lead in their water. Or lead in their pencil. Had the highest murder rate of any sizable U.S. city in 2012. You know, a third of those people in Flint, Michigan are white. God, they must have to have their windows all with bulletproof glass. There were 62 murders per 100,000 population in Flint. Trailing Flint were Detroit, 54.6 murders per 100,000. New Orleans, 53.2 per 100,000. And Jackson, Mississippi, 35.8 per 100,000. Chicago, whose population is several times bigger than any of those cities, came in 21st. With 18.5 murders per 100,000, nearly quadruple the national average, true, but still nowhere near the highest in the country. Well, that's interesting information there. I guess the untouchables are not as bad in Chicago as we thought. But Chicago does rank in the top four of high crime, murders, racial tensions, and corruption, along with Paris, Rome, and Athens, Greece. Chicago now ranks in the top four. Well, here's an interesting little story about World War II and Hitler and assassination. Quote, in 1933, this fellow who wrote this, a Jew, was approached by someone respectable, a Jew not involved in any criminal activity. He must have had to go a long way to find that one, and asked for my help. He wanted me to contact some of my underworld pals in a plan to kill Hitler, unquote. I stared at the man sitting across from me. I was incredulous. A plan to kill Hitler? in 1933 involving Jewish American mobsters. Was he serious? The story seemed far-fetched. A Bubba Masaya old wives' tale. I was skeptical. Still, I wrote down what he told me, and he said the hitmen or men selected for the job had to be Yiddish speakers so they could get around any language problems in Germany. He said they would be paid $2,500 plus expenses. He said the respectable Jew told him there are people in Germany ready to assist us. This is how he remembered the scheme to kill Hitler. My source's nickname was Dutch. He was one of the elderly retired mobsters I interviewed for my book, but he was good to his mother. The Lives and Crimes of Jewish Gangsters is the title of the book. According to my notes, I met him on August 15, 1988 at the Picasso Cafe in Herzliya Petua, an upscale seaside suburb of Herzliya, 15 miles north of Tel Aviv. When we met, he was living in Israel. He said, quote, "My friends call me Dutch. You seem okay, so call me Dutch too," unquote. This was our only face-to-face meeting, and he asked me not to use his family name while he was still alive. I promised him I would not. He died in 1993. Later, I learned that his last name was Goldberg. Surprise, surprise. As far as I know, I was the last person he spoke to about this. Okay. I recall Dutch as being about 5'7" and stocky build with thinning gray hair. I estimated his age to be somewhere in the 80s. I surmised that he must have been good looking in his youth. But time has taken its toll. His skin showed age spots, and his right hand shook slightly when he lifted his coffee cup. At first, he asked me to tell him about my work and my background and why I wanted to speak to him. I told him that I'd grown up in Detroit, got my doctorate in history at the University of Michigan, and was teaching at Tel Aviv University. I explained that I was researching Jews and organized crime in the United States. Heaven to Murgatory, Jews involved in organized crime? I can't believe that, goddamn bunch of anti-Semitic. We then discussed some underworld figures, including Meyer Lansky. Oh, I thought he was Irish, whom I interviewed in 1980. Dutch looked at me for a while. "Gangsters," he said. "Why is a nice Jewish professor like you writing about that stuff? There are a lot of other things you could write about, but gangsters is not one of them," unquote. For the next 10 minutes or so, we went back and forth about my research and topics Dutch thought I could pursue. Then he told me about his background. He said he grew up on New York's Lower East Side. There must have been a million Jews on the Lower East Side. He dropped out of school at age 13 and stole from peddlers and robbed drunks to make some money. Because he was tough and a good fighter, he worked as a muscle man, and for a price he would beat up someone who owed money. He sometimes worked as a strike breaker and for bootleggers during the Prohibition, guarding their shipments of illegal liquor for the Kennedys. He claimed he was arrested more than 40 times and said he had killed more than one man. In early 1930s, he became a soldier in the Bugsy Siegel, Meyer Lansky mob in New York. Wow. Dutch finished his story about the alleged scheme to kill Hitler by saying that after he had been approached, he talked to some of the boys about it. They hated the Nazis and knew what was happening to the Jews, and they were willing to go to Germany and do the job. But before the contract could be formalized, that bastard J. Edgar Hoover and his feds started snooping around asking questions. So the boys thought it was wise to drop the matter. It was bad for business. Reflecting on the plot, Dutch concluded, quote, "It was really a shame. I wish we'd done it and killed the son of a bitch." Now, remember, at this point, Hitler is a strictly legal leader of a country, 33. He hadn't really done anything that that would warrant assassination. Can you imagine? We would have been heroes. They would have given us all medals. When we finished, I asked him if he had hard evidence on this plot. Evidence, he asked. What kind of evidence? I'm talking about documents, letters. I'm a historian, after all. I like documents. He laughed. You got to be kidding, he said. There's no documents. A moment later, though, Dutch told me that Hoover probably wrote something about it and that maybe I should check with Washington. Another former Jewish mobsters I had interviewed told me how they had helped Jews and how they had taken action against anti-Semites and Nazi Bundes in the United States during the 30s. Maybe they were trying to impress me. Maybe in their old age they wanted to erase some of the nefarious deeds of their youth. They conveniently forgot to tell me that they got their start in crime by beating and robbing Jews in their own neighborhood. The same I thought might be true with Dutch. Maybe he made the story up or told me what he thought I wanted to hear. A year later, I was doing research at the archives in the FBI building in Washington. I was seated at a desk waiting for a file to be brought to me when a file on the adjacent table caught my eye. It was labeled Adolf Hitler. I wondered why the FBI would have a file on Hitler. I opened the file and found memos, reports, and letters documenting an alleged attempt by American Jews to assassinate Hitler in 1933. Maybe Dutch had told me the truth. The file, number 65-53615, in case you want to look it up, details a plot involving one man. The plot passed the initial planning stage, but may have been foiled by the U.S. Department of Justice. How about that? Coming to the aid of Adolf Hitler. In an effort to prevent an international incident, an American citizen assassinating a German leader, American law enforcement officials might have helped save Hitler. The tale of the conspiracy to kill the German chancellor came to attention of the American government by the way of a letter dated March 23, 1933, typed on plain white paper addressed to the German ambassador, Washington, D.C. The ambassador passed the letter to the Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, on March 28, and Hull forwarded it to the U.S. Attorney General Homer Cummings, and it read this way. I have asked President Roosevelt to publicly remonstrate with your government about the outrages committed upon the Jews in Germany and to demand an immediate and complete end to this persecution. In the event that he does not make such a statement, I notify you that I shall go to Germany and assassinate Hitler. Yours sincerely, Daniel Stern. German diplomats demanded an immediate and full investigation of the threat. It should be mentioned that the German ambassador, Frederick Wilhelm von Prittwitz, resigned from the German government in April 1933 in protest over Hitler's appointment as chancellor. Franklin Roosevelt had been in office only a few weeks and had a nationwide depression to contend with. Events in Germany, including Hitler's ascension to power, hardly concerned with the government or most of the American public. Nonetheless, the threat expressed in the letter could not be ignored or simply attributed to a crank. More militant members of the American Jewish community had reacted to Hitler's anti-Semitic policies by taking to the streets. Hundreds picketed the German consulate, businesses, and stores selling German products. Thousands attended protest rallies and parades in New York, Chicago, Cleveland, Detroit, and other cities. In this atmosphere, Stern's personal declaration of war against Hitler was taken serious. Yeah. You know, I think what I'm going to do, since this is a longer, I'm not sure quite how long it goes. It's pretty long. I'm going to send this to you by email so you can read it yourself. Pretty interesting, right? It's quite a story. Once the Germans found out about this, they should have dispatched a few agents to the United States to kill Roosevelt. You try to go after our Führer, we go after your Führer. Okay? All right. We won't even have to have a war. Well, that's it for today, boys and girls. On Wednesday, Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day, and tomorrow is Thor's Day. And we'll be back with you with more exciting, tremendous stuff that probably you don't read too much in the kept right-wing conservative end of the news. So, there you go.
Cars may be as different as...
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together?